O young child, that you have forgotten that just as God can cleanse a person's flesh of leprosy, he can also cleanse your soul of sin.
Oh, I don't know,
she sobbed, hiding her face on his arm. I don't know. And I don't feel any remorse, Gunulf. I'm afraid, and yet... I was afraid when I stood at the church door with Erland and the priest married us. I was afraid when I went inside for the wedding mass with him, with the golden crown on my flowing hair, for I didn't dare speak of shame to my father, with all my sins unatoned for. I didn't even dare confess fully to my parish priest. But as I went about here this winter, and saw myself growing more hideous for each day that passed, then I was even more frightened, for Erland did not act toward me as he had before. I thought about those days when he would come to me in my chamber at Skog in the evenings. Kristen, the priest tried to lift her face, you mustn't think about this now. Think about God, who sees your sorrow and your remorse. Turn to the gentle Virgin Mary, who takes pity on every sorrowful.
Don't you see? I drove another human being to take her own life.
Kristen, the priest said sternly, are you so arrogant that you think yourself capable of sinning so badly that God's mercy is not great enough? He stroked her wimple over and over. Don't you remember, my sister, when the devil tried to tempt St. Martin? Then the fiend asked St. Martin whether he dared believe it when he promised God's mercy to all the sinners whose confessions he heard. And the bishop answered, even to you, I promise God's forgiveness at the very instant you ask for it, if only you will give up your pride and believe that his love is greater than your hatred. Gunulf continued to stroke the head of the weeping woman. All the while he thought, was this the way that Erland had behaved toward his young bride? His lips grew pale and grim at the thought. Audfinna Auden's daughter was the first of the women to arrive. She found Kristen in the little house. Gunulf was sitting with her, and a couple of maids were bustling about the room. Audfinna greeted the priest with deference, but Kristen stood up and went toward her with her hand outstretched.
I must give you thanks for coming, Audfinna. I know it's not easy for your family to be without you at home.
Gunulf had given the woman a searching look. Now he too stood up and said, it was good of you to come so quickly. My sister-in-law needs someone she can trust to be with her. She's a stranger here, young and inexperienced.
Jesus, she's as white as her linen wimple, whispered Audfinna.
Do you think, sir, that I might give her a sleeping potion? She needs to rest a while before it gets much worse. She set to work, quietly and efficiently, inspecting the bed that the servant women had prepared on the floor, and telling them to bring more cushions and straw. She put small stone vessels of herbs on the fire to heat. Then she proceeded to loosen all the ribbons and ties on Kristen's clothing, and finally she pulled out all the pins from the ill woman's hair. I've never seen anything so lovely, she said when the cascading, silky, golden-brown mane tumbled down around the pale face. She had to laugh. It certainly hasn't lost much of either fullness or sheen, even though you went bareheaded a little longer than was proper. She settled Kristen comfortably among the cushions on the floor and covered her with a blanket. Drink this now, and you won't feel the pains as much, and see if you can sleep a little now and then. Gunulf was ready to leave. He went over and bent down toward Kristen.
You will pray for me, Gunulf? She implored him.
I will pray for you until I see you with your child in your arms. And after that, too, he said as he tucked her hand back under the covers. Kristen lay there, dozing. She felt almost content. The pain in her loins came and went. But it was unlike anything she had ever felt before, so that each time it was over, she wondered whether she had just imagined it. After the anguish and dread of the early morning hours, she felt as if she were already beyond the worst fear and torment. Audfinna walked about quietly, hanging up the infant clothes, blankets, and furs to warm at the hearth, and stirring her pots a little so the room smelled of spices. Finally, Kristen slept between each wave of pain. She thought she was back home in the brew house at Urengard, and was supposed to help her mother dye a large woven fabric, probably because of the steam from the ash bark and nettles. Then the neighbor women arrived, one after another, wives from the estates in the parish and in Birgsey. Audfinna withdrew to her place with the maids. Toward evening, Kristen began to suffer terrible pain. The women told her to walk around as long as she could bear it. This tormented her greatly. The house was now crowded with women, and she had to walk around like a mare that was for sale. Now and then she had to let the women squeeze and touch her body all over, and then they would confer with each other. At last, Fru Gunna from Rolfsvold, who was in charge of things, said that now Kristen could lie down on the floor. She divided up the women, some to sleep and some to keep watch. "This isn't going to pass quickly, but go ahead and scream, Kristen, when it hurts, and don't pay any mind to those who are sleeping. We're all here to help you, poor child," she said, gentle and kind, patting the young woman's cheek. But Kristen lay there biting her lips to shreds and crushing the corners of the blanket in her sweaty hands. It was suffocatingly hot, but they told her that was as it should be. After each wave of pain, the sweat poured off her. At times she would lie there thinking about food for all these women. She fervently wanted them to see that she kept good order in her house. She had asked Torbjörg, the cook, to put whey in the water for boiling the fresh fish. If only Gunnulf wouldn't regard this as breaking the fast. Sira Eirik had said that it wasn't, for whey was not milk, and the fish broth would be thrown out. They mustn't be allowed to taste the dried fish that Erland had brought home in the fall, spoiled and full of mites that it was. "Blessed Virgin Mary, will it be long before you help me? Oh, how it hurts, it hurts, it hurts." She was trying to hold out a little longer before she gave in and screamed. Audfinna sat next to the hearth and tended the pots of water. Kristen wished that she dared ask her to come over and hold her hand. There was nothing she wouldn't give to hold on to a familiar and kind hand right now. But she was ashamed to ask for it. The next morning, a bewildered silence hovered over Husaby. It was the day before the Feast of the Annunciation, and the farm work was supposed to be finished by mid-afternoon prayers, but the men were distracted and somber, and the frightened maids were careless with their chores. The servants had grown fond of their young mistress, and it was said that things were not going well for her. Erland stood outside in the courtyard, talking to his smith. He tried to keep his thoughts on what the man was saying. Then Fru Gunna came rushing over to him. "There's no progress with your wife, Erland. We've tried everything we know. You must come. It might help if she sits on your lap. Go in and change into a short tunic, but be quick. She's suffering greatly, your poor young wife." Erland had turned blood red. He remembered he had heard that if a woman was having trouble delivering a child she had conceived in secrecy, then it might help if she were placed on her husband's knee. Kristen was lying on the floor under several blankets. Two women were sitting with her. The moment that Erland came in, he saw her body convulse, and she buried her head in the lap of one of the women, rocking it from side to side. But she didn't utter a single whimper. When the pain had passed, she looked up with wild, frightened eyes, her cracked brown lips gasping. All trace of youth and beauty had vanished from the swollen, flushed red face. Even her hair was matted together with bits of straw and wool from the fur of a filthy hide. She looked at Erland as if she didn't immediately recognize him. But when she realized why the women had sent for him, she shook her head vigorously. "It's not the custom where I come from, for men to be present when a woman is giving birth." "It's sometimes done here in the north," said Erland quietly. "If it can lessen the pain a little for you, my Kristen, then you must."
"Oh."
When he knelt beside her, she threw her arms around his waist and pressed herself to him. Hunched over and shaking, she fought her way through the pain without a murmur.
May I have a few words with my husband alone?
She said when it was over, her breathing rapid and harsh. The women withdrew.
Was it when she was suffering the agony of childbirth that you promised her what she told me? That you would marry her when she was widowed? That night when Orm was born?
Whispered Kristen. Erland gasped for air, as if he had been struck deep in the heart. Then he vehemently shook his head. I was at the castle that night. My men and I had guard duty. It was when I came back to our hostel in the morning and they put the boy in my arms. Have you been lying here thinking about this, Kristen?
Yes.
Again she clung to him as the waves of pain washed over her. Erland wiped away the sweat that poured down her face. Now you know, he said, when she lay quiet once more. Don't you want me to stay with you, as Fruguna says? But Kristen shook her head, and finally the women had to let Erland go. But then it seemed as if her power to endure was broken. She screamed in wild terror of the pain that she could feel approaching, and begged pitifully for help. And yet, when the women talked of bringing her husband back, she screamed, "No!" She would rather be tortured to death. Gunnulf and the cleric who was with him walked over to the church to attend evensong. Everyone on the estate went along who was not tending to the woman giving birth. But Erland slipped out of the church before the service was over and walked south toward the buildings. In the west, above the ridges on the other side of the valley, the sky was a yellowish red. The twilight of the spring evening was about to descend, clear and bright and mild. A few stars appeared, white in the light sky. A little wisp of fog drifted over the bare woods down by the lake, and there were brown patches where the fields lay open to the sun. The smell of earth and thawing snow filled the air. The little house was at the westernmost edge of the courtyard, facing the hollow of the valley. Erland went over and stood for a moment behind the wall. The timbers were still warm from the sun as he leaned against them. Oh, how she screamed. He had once heard a heifer shrieking in the grip of a bear. That was up at their mountain pasture, and he was only a half-grown boy. He and Arnbjorn, the shepherd boy, were running south through the forest. He remembered the shaggy creature that stood up and became a bear with a red, fiery maw. The bear broke Arnbjorn's spear in half with its paw. Then the servant threw Erland's spear, as he stood there paralyzed with terror. The heifer lay there still alive, but its udder and thigh had been gnawed away. My Kristen, oh my Kristen, Lord, for the sake of your blessed mother, have mercy. He rushed back to the church. The maids came into the hall with the evening meal. They didn't set up the table, but placed the food near the hearth. The men took bread and fish over to the benches, sat down in their places, not speaking and eating little. No one seemed to have an appetite. No one came to clear away the dishes after the meal, and none of the men got up to go to bed. They stayed sitting there, staring into the hearth fire, without talking. Erland had hidden himself in a corner near the bed. He couldn't bear to have anyone see his face. Master Gunnulf had lit a small oil lamp and set it on the arm of the high seat. He sat on the bench with a book in his hands, his lips moving gently, soundless and unceasing. At one point, Ulf Haldorsson stood up, walked forward to the hearth, and picked up a piece of soft bread. He rummaged around among the pieces of firewood and selected one. Then he went over to the corner near the doorway where Old Man Aun was sitting. The two of them fiddled with the bread, hidden behind Ulf's cape. Aun whittled and cut the piece of wood. The men cast a glance in their direction now and then. In a little while, Ulf and Aun got up and left the hall. Gunnulf watched them go, but said nothing. He took up his prayers once more. Once a young boy toppled off the bench, falling to the floor in his sleep. He got up and looked around in bewilderment. Then he sighed softly and sat down again. Ulf Haldorsson and Aun quietly came back in and returned to the places where they had sat before. The men looked at them, but no one said a word. Suddenly Erlon jumped up. He strode across the floor toward his servants. He was hollow-eyed, and his face was as gray as clay.
"Doesn't anyone know what to do?" he asked.
"You, Aun," he whispered.
"It didn't help," replied Ulf, his voice equally quiet.
"It could be that she's not meant to keep this child," said Aun, wiping his nose.
"Then neither sacrifices nor runes can help.
It's a shame for you, Erlon, that you should lose this good wife so soon."
"Oh, don't talk as if she were already dead," implored Erlon, broken and in despair.
He went back to his corner and threw himself down on the enclosed bed with his head near the footboard. Later, a man went outside and then came back in.
"The moon is up," he said.
"It will soon be morning." A few minutes later, Fru Gunna came into the hall. She sank down onto the beggar's bench near the door. Her gray hair was disheveled. Her wimple had slid back onto her shoulders. The men stood up and slowly moved over to her.
"One of you must come and hold her," she said, weeping. "We have no more strength. You must go to her, Gunnulf. There's no telling how this will end."
Gunnulf stood up and tucked his prayer book inside his belt pouch.
"You must come too, Erlon," said the woman.
A raw and broken howl met him in the doorway. Erlon stopped and shivered. He caught a glimpse of Kristin's contorted, unrecognizable face among the sobbing women. She was on her knees, and they were supporting her. Over by the door, several servant women were kneeling at the benches. They were praying loudly and steadily. He threw himself down next to them and hid his head in his arms. She screamed and screamed, and each time he felt himself freeze with incredulous horror. It couldn't possibly be like this. He ventured a glance in her direction. Now Gunnulf was sitting on a stool in front of her and holding her under the arms. Fru Gunna was kneeling at her side with her arms around Kristen's waist, but Kristen was fighting her, frightened to death, and trying to push the other woman away.
"Oh no, oh no, let me go. I can't do it. God, God, help me."
"God will help you soon, Kristen," said the priest each time. A woman held a basin of water, and after each wave of pain, he would take a wet cloth and wipe the sick woman's face, along the roots of her hair and in between her lips, from which saliva was dripping. Then she would rest her head in Gunnulf's arms and doze off for a moment, but the torment would instantly tear her out of her sleep again. And the priest continued to say, "Now, Kristen, you will have help soon." No one had any idea what time of night it was anymore. The dawn was already a gray glare in the smoke vent. Then, after a long, mad howl of terror, everything fell silent. Erlond heard the women rushing around. He didn't want to look up. Then he heard someone weeping loudly and he cringed again, not wanting to know. Then Kristen shrieked once more, a piercing, wild cry of lament that didn't sound like the insane, inhuman animal cries of before. Erlon leaped up. Gunnulf was bending down and holding on to Kristen, who was still on her knees. She was staring with deathly horror at something that Fru Gunna was holding in a sheepskin. The raw and dark red shape looked like nothing more than the entrails from a slaughtered beast. The priest pulled her close.
"Dear Kristen, you have given birth to as fine and handsome a son as any mother should thank God for. And he's breathing," said Gunnulf fiercely to the weeping women. "He's breathing. God would not be so harsh as not to hear us."
And as the priest spoke, it happened. Through the exhausted, confused mind of the mother tumbled, hazily recalled, the sight of a bud she had seen in the cloister garden. Something from which red, crinkled wisps of silk emerged and spread out to become a flower. The shapeless lump moved. It whimpered.
It stretched out and became a very tiny wine-red infant in human form. It had arms and legs and hands and feet with fully formed fingers and toes. It flailed and hissed a bit.
"So tiny, so tiny, so tiny he is," she cried in a thin, broken voice, and then burst into laughing sobs.
The women around her began to laugh and wipe their tears, and Gunnulf gave Kristin into their arms.
"Roll him in a trencher, so he can scream better," said the priest, as he followed the women carrying the newborn son over to the hearth.
When Kristin awoke from a long faint, she was lying in bed. Someone had removed the dreadful sweat-soaked garments, and a feeling of warmth and healing was blessedly streaming through her body. They had placed small pouches of warm nettle porridge on her and wrapped her in hot blankets and furs. Someone hushed her when she tried to speak. It was quite still in the room. But through the silence came a voice that she couldn't quite recognize.
"Nikolaus, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost."
There was the sound of water trickling. Kristin propped herself up on her elbow to take a look. Over by the hearth stood a priest in white garb, and Ulf Haldorsson was lifting a kicking, red, naked child out of the large brass basin. He handed him to the godmother, and then took the lit taper. She had given birth to a child, and he was screaming so loudly that the priest's words were almost drowned out. But she was so tired. She felt numb and wanted to sleep. Then she heard Erlan's voice. He spoke quickly and with alarm.
"His head. He has such a strange head."
"He's swollen up," said the woman calmly, "and it's no wonder. He had to fight hard for his life, this boy."
Kristin shouted something. She felt as if she were suddenly awake, to the very depths of her heart. This was her son, and he had fought for his life, just as she had.
Gunnulf turned around at once and laughed. He seized the tiny white bundle from Fru Gunna's lap and carried it over to the bed. He placed the boy in his mother's arms. Weak with tenderness and joy, she rubbed her face against the little bit of red, silky soft face visible among the linen wrappings. She glanced up at Erland. Once before she had seen his face look this haggard and gray. She couldn't remember when. Her head felt so dizzy and strange, but she knew that it was good she had no memory of it. And it was good to see him standing there with his brother. The priest had his hand on Erland's shoulder. An immeasurable sense of peace and well-being came over her as she looked at the tall man wearing alb and stole. The round, lean face beneath the black fringe of hair was strong, but his smile was pleasant and kind. Erland drove his dagger deep into the wall timber behind the mother and child.
"That's not necessary now," said the priest with a laugh. "The boy has been baptized after all."
Kristin suddenly remembered something that Brother Edvin once said. A newly baptized child was just as holy as the holy angels in heaven. The sins of the parents were washed from the child, and he had not yet committed any sins of his own. Fearful and cautious, she kissed the little face. Fru Gunna came over to them. She was worn out and exhausted and angry at the father, who had not had the sense to offer a single word of thanks to all the women who had helped. And the priest had taken the child from her and carried him over to his mother. She should have done that, both because she had delivered the woman and because she was the godmother of the boy.
"You haven't yet greeted your son, Erland, or held him in your arms," she said crossly.
Erland lifted the swaddled infant from the mother's arms. For a moment he lay his face close.
"I don't think I'm going to be properly fond of you, Nokve, until I forget what terrible suffering you caused your mother," he said,
and then gave the boy back to Kristin.
"By all means, give him the blame for that," said the old woman, annoyed.
Master Gunnulf laughed, and then Fru Gunna laughed with him. She wanted to take the child and put him in his cradle, but Kristin begged to keep him with her for a while. A moment later, she fell asleep with her son beside her, vaguely noticing that Erlan touched her cautiously,
as if he were afraid to hurt her. And then she was sound asleep again. Chapter 5. In the morning of the 10th day after the child's birth, Master Gunnulf said to his brother when they were alone in the hall, "It's about time now, Erlund, for you to send word to your wife's kinsmen about how things are with her." "I don't think there's any haste with that," replied Erlund. "I doubt they will be overly glad at Jorungard when they hear that there's already a son here on the manor. Don't you think Kristen's mother would have realized last fall that her daughter was unwell?" Gunnulf asked. "She must be worried by now." Erlund didn't say a word in reply. But later in the day, as Gunnulf was sitting in the little house and talking to Kristen, Erlund came in. He was wearing a fur cap on his head, a short, thick homespun coat, long pants, and furry boots. He bent down to his wife and patted her cheek. "So, dear Kristen, do you have any greetings you wish to send to Jorungard? I'm heading there now to bring word of our son." Kristen blushed bright red. She looked both frightened and happy. "It's no more than your father would demand of me," said Erlund somberly, "that I bring the news myself." Kristen lay in silence for a moment. "Tell them at home," she said softly, "that I have yearned every day since I left home to fall at father's and mother's feet to beg their forgiveness." A few minutes later, Erlund left. Kristen didn't think to ask how he would travel, but Gunnulf went out to the courtyard with his brother. Next to the doorway of the main house stood Erlund's skis and a staff with a spear point.
"You're going to ski there?" asked Gunnulf. "Who's going with you?"
"Nobody," replied Erlund, laughing. "You should know best of all, Gunnulf, that it's not easy for anyone to keep up with me on skis."
"This seems reckless to me," said the priest. "There are many wolves in the mountain forests this year, they say."
Erlund merely laughed and began to strap on his skis.
"I was thinking of heading up through the Jeitskar pastures before it gets dark. It will be light for a long time yet. I can make it to Jorungard on the evening of the third day."
"The path from Jeitskar to the road is uncertain, and there are bad patches of fog there too. You know it's unsafe up in the mountain pastures in the wintertime."
"You can lend me your flint," said Erlund in the same tone of voice, "in case I should need to throw mine away at some elf woman if she demands such courtesies of me as would be unseemly for a married man. Listen, brother. I'm doing now what you said I should do, going to Kristen's father to ask him to demand whatever penances from me that he finds reasonable. Surely you can allow me to decide this much, that I myself choose how I will travel."
And with that, Master Gunnulf had to be content. But he sternly commanded the servants to conceal from Kristen that Erlund had set off alone. To the south, the sky arched pale yellow over the blue-tinged snowdrifts of the mountains on the evening when Erlund came racing down past the churchyard, making the snow crust creak and shriek. High overhead hovered the crescent moon, shining white and dewy in the twilight. At Jorungard, dark smoke was swirling up from the smoke vents against the pale, clear sky. The sound of an axe rang out cold and rhythmic in the stillness. At the entrance to the courtyard, a pack of dogs started barking loudly at the approaching man. Inside the courtyard, a group of shaggy goats ambled around, dark silhouettes in the clear dusk. They were nibbling at a heap of fir boughs in the middle of the courtyard. Three winter-clad youngsters were running among them. The peace of the place made an oddly deep impression on Erlund. He stood there, irresolute, and waited for Lavrans, who was coming forward to greet the stranger. His father-in-law had been over by the woodshed, talking to a man splitting rails for a fence. Lavron stopped abruptly when he recognized his son-in-law. He thrust the spear he was holding hard into the snow.
"Is that you?" he asked in a low voice.
"Alone?
Is something..."
And a moment later he said,
"How is it that you've come here like this?"
"Here's the reason." Erlund pulled himself together and looked his father-in-law in the eye.
I thought I could do no less than to come here myself to bring you the news. Kristen gave birth to a son on the morning of the Feast of the Annunciation. And yes, she is doing well now, he added quickly. Lavron stood in silence for a moment. He was biting down hard on his lip. His jaw trembled and quivered faintly.
That was news indeed, he said then.
Little Romborg had come over to stand at her father's side. She looked up, her face flaming red.
Be quiet, said Lavrans harshly, even though the maiden hadn't uttered a word, but had merely blushed. Don't stand here. Go away.
He didn't say anything more. Erland stood leaning forward, with his left hand gripping his staff. His eyes were fixed on the snow. He had stuck his right hand inside his tunic. Lavrans pointed.
Have you injured yourself?
A little, said Erland.
I slipped down a slope yesterday in the dark.
Lavrans touched his wrist and pressed it cautiously.
I don't think there are any bones broken, he said. You can tell her mother yourself.
He started for the house as Ronfrid came out into the courtyard. She looked in amazement at her husband. Then she recognized Erland and quickly walked over to him. She listened without speaking as Erland for the second time presented his message. But her eyes filled with tears when Erland said at the end,
I thought you might have noticed something before she left here in the fall, and that you might be worried about her now.
It was kind of you, Erland, she said uncertainly, for you to think of that. I think I've been worried every day since you took her away from us.
Lavrans came back.
Here is some fox fat. I see that you've frozen your cheek, son-in-law. You must stay for a while in the entryway so Ronfrid can attend to it and thaw you out. How are your feet? You must take off your boots so we can see.
When the servants came in for the evening meal, Lavrans told them the news and ordered special foreign ale to be brought in so they could celebrate. But there was no real merriment about the occasion. The master himself sat at the table with a cup of water. He asked Erland to forgive him, but this was a promise he had made during his youth, to drink water during Lent. And so the servants sat there quietly, and the conversation lagged over the good ale. Once in a while the children would go over to Lavrans. He put his arm around them when they stood at his knee, but he gave absent-minded answers to their questions. Romborg replied curtly and sharply when Erland tried to tease her. She would show that she didn't like this brother-in-law of hers. She was now 8 winters old, lively and lovely, but she bore little resemblance to her sisters. Erland asked who the other children were. Lavrans told him the boy was Havard Tronson, the youngest child at Sundbø. It was so tedious for him over there among his grown-up siblings. At Christmas time, he had decided to go home with his aunt. The maiden was Helga Rolf's daughter. Her kinsmen had been forced to take the children from Blakarsarv home with them after the funeral. It wasn't good for them to see their father the way he was now. And it was nice for Romborg that she had these foster siblings.
We're getting old now, Ronfrid and I, said Lavrans. And she's more wild and playful, this one here, than Kristen was.
He stroked his daughter's curly hair. Erland sat down next to his mother-in-law, and she asked him about Kristen's childbirth. The son-in-law noticed that Lavrans was listening to them, but then he stood up, went over, and picked up his hat and cape. He would go over to the parsonage, he said, to ask Sira Eirik to come and join them for a drink. Lavrans walked along the well-trodden path through the fields toward Romengard. The moon was about to sink behind the mountains now, but thousands of stars still sparkled above the white slopes. He hoped the priest would be at home. He could no longer stand to sit there with the others. But when he turned down the lane between the fences near the courtyard, he saw a small candle coming toward him. Old Auden was carrying it, and when he sensed there was someone in the road, he rang his tiny silver bell. Lavrans Björgulfsson threw himself down on his knees in the snowdrift at the side of the road.
Auden walked past with his candle and bell, which rang faintly and gently. Behind him rode Sira Eirik. With his hands, he lifted the host vessel high as he came upon the kneeling man, but he did not turn his head. He rode silently past as Lavrans bowed down and raised his hands in greeting to his savior. That was the son of Einar Nuta with the priest. It must be nearing the end for the old man now. Ah well. Lavrans said his prayers for the dying man before he stood up and walked back home. The meeting with God in the night had nevertheless strengthened and consoled him a great deal. When they had gone to bed, Lavrans asked his wife, "Did you know anything about this? That things were such with Kristen?"
"Didn't you?" said Ronfrid.
"No," replied her husband so curtly that she could tell he must have been thinking of it all the same.
"I was indeed fearful for a time this past summer," said the mother hesitantly. "I could see that she took no pleasure in her food. But as the days passed, I thought I must have been mistaken. She seemed so happy during all the time we were preparing for her wedding."
"Well, she certainly had good reason for that," said the father with some disdain. "But that she said nothing to you. You, her own mother."
"Yes. You think of that now when she's gone astray," said Ronfrid bitterly. "But you know quite well that Kristen has never confided in me." Lavran said no more. A little later he bade his wife sleep well, and then lay down quietly. He realized that sleep would not come to him for some time. Kristen, Kristen. His poor little maiden. Not with a single word had he ever referred to what Ronfrid had confessed to him on the night of Kristen's wedding. And in all fairness, she couldn't say he had made her feel it was on his mind. He had been no different in his demeanor toward her. Rather, he had striven to show her even more kindness and love. But it was not the first time this winter he had noticed the bitterness in Ronfrid, or seen her searching for some hidden offense in the innocent words he had spoken. He didn't understand it, and he didn't know what to do about it. He would simply have to accept it. "Our Father, who art in heaven." He prayed for Kristen and her child. Then he prayed for his wife and for himself. Finally, he prayed for the strength to tolerate Erlon Nikolausen with a patient spirit, for as long as he was forced to have his son-in-law there on his estate. Lavrans would not allow his daughter's husband to set off for home until they saw how his wrist was healing. And he refused to let Erlon go back alone. "Kristen would be pleased if you came with me," said Erlon one day. Lavrans was silent for a moment. Then he voiced many objections. Ronfrid would undoubtedly not like to be left alone on the farm. And once he had journeyed so far north, it would be difficult to return in time for spring planting. But in the end, he set off with Erlund. He took no servant along. He would travel home by ship to Raumsdal. There he could hire horses to carry him south through the valley. He knew people everywhere along the way. They talked little as they skied, but they got along well together. It was a struggle for Lavrans to keep up with his companion. He didn't want to admit that his son-in-law went too fast for him. But Erlon took note of this and at once adapted his pace to his father-in-law's. He went to great lengths to charm his wife's father, and he had that quiet, gentle manner whenever he wished to win someone's friendship. On the third evening, they sought shelter in a stone hut. They had had bad weather and fog, but Erlon seemed to be able to find his way just as confidently. Lavrans noticed that Erlon had an astoundingly accurate knowledge of all signs and tracks, in the air and on the ground, and of the ways of animals and their habits. And he always seemed to know where he was. Everything that Lavrans, experienced in the mountains as he was, had learned by observing and paying attention and remembering, the other man seemed to intuit quite blindly. Erlon laughed at this, but it was simply something he knew. They found the stone hut in the dark,
exactly at the moment Erland had predicted. Lavrans recalled one such night when he had dug himself a shelter in the snow, only an arrow's shot away from his own horse shed. Here the snow had drifted up over the hut, and they had to break their way in through the smoke vent. Erland covered the opening with a horse hide that was lying in the hut, fastening it with sticks of firewood, which he stuck in among the roof beams. With a ski, he cleared away the snow that had blown inside and managed to build a fire in the hearth from the frozen wood lying about. He pulled out 3 or 4 grouse from under the bench. He had put them there on his way south. He packed them in earth from the floor, where it had thawed out around the hearth, and then threw the bundles into the embers. Lavran stretched out on the earthen bench, which Erland had prepared for him as best he could, spreading out their knapsacks and capes.
"That's what soldiers do with stolen chickens, Erland," he said with a laugh. "Yes, I learned a few things when I was in the Earl's service," said Erland, laughing too.
Now he was alert and lively, not silent and rather sluggish the way his father-in-law had most often seen him. As he sat on the floor in front of Lavrans, he started telling stories about the years when he served Earl Jakob in Holland. He had been head of the castle guard, and he had patrolled the coast with 3 small ships. Erland's eyes shone like a child's. He wasn't boasting. He merely let the words spill out. Lavrans lay there looking down at him. He had prayed to God to grant him patience with this man, his daughter's husband. Now he was almost angry with himself, because he was more fond of Erland than he wanted to be. He thought about that night when their church burned down, and he had taken a liking to his son-in-law. It was not that Erland lacked manhood in his lanky body. Lavrans felt a stab of pain in his heart. It was a pity about Erland. He could have been fit for better things than seducing women. But nothing much had come of that except boyish pranks. If only times had been such that a chieftain could have taken this man in hand and put him to use. But as the world was now, when every man had to depend on his own judgment about so many things, and a man in Erland's circumstances was supposed to make decisions for himself and for the welfare of many other people. And this was Kristen's husband. Erland looked up at his father-in-law. He grew somber, too. Then he said, "I want to ask one thing, Lavrans. Before we reach my home, I'd like you to tell me what is in your heart." Lavrans was silent. "You must know," said Erland in the same tone of voice, "that I would gladly fall at your feet in whatever manner you wish, and make amends in whatever way you deem a fitting punishment for me." Lavrans looked down into the younger man's face. Then he smiled oddly.
"That might be difficult, Erland, for me to decide and for you to do. But now you must make a proper gift to the church at Sunbu and to the priests, whom you have also deceived," he said adamantly. "I will speak no more of this. And you cannot blame it on your youth. It would have been much more honorable, Erland, if you had fallen at my feet before you held your wedding." "Yes," said Erland. "But at the time I didn't know how things stood, or that it would come to light that I had offended you."
Lavran sat up.
"Didn't you know, when you were wed, that Kristen—"
"No," said Erland, looking crestfallen.
"We were married for almost 2 months before I realized it."
Lavrans gave him a look of surprise, but said nothing. Then Erland spoke again, his voice low and unsteady.
"I'm glad that you came with me, father-in-law. Kristen has been so melancholy all winter. She's hardly said a word to me. Many times it seemed to me that she was unhappy, both with Husabi and with me."
Lavrans replied somewhat coldly and harshly,
"That's no doubt the way things are with most young wives. Now that she's well again, you two will probably be just as good friends as you were before."
And he smiled a little mockingly. But Erland sat and stared into the glowing embers. He suddenly understood with certainty. but he had realized it from the moment he first saw the tiny red infant face pressed against Kristen's white shoulder. It would never be the same between them, the way it had been before. When Kristen's father stepped inside the little house, she sat up in bed and held out her arms toward him. She threw her arms around his shoulders and wept, until Lavrans grew quite alarmed. She had been out of bed for some time, but then she learned that Erland had set off for Gudbrandsdal alone, and when he failed to return home for days on end, she grew so anxious that she developed a fever, and she had to go back to bed. It was apparent that she was still weak. She wept at everything. The new manor priest, Sira Eiliv Sirkson, had arrived while Erland was away. He had taken it upon himself to visit the mistress now and then to read to her. But she wept over such unreasonable things that soon he didn't know what he dared let her hear. One day when her father was sitting with her, Kristen wanted to change the child herself so that he could see how handsome and well-formed the boy was. He lay naked on the swaddling clothes, kicking on the wool coverlet in front of his mother.
"What kind of a mark is that on his chest?" asked Lavrans.
Right over his heart, the child had several little blood-red flecks. It looked as if a bloody hand had touched the boy there. Kristen had been distressed by it too, the first time she saw this mark. But she had tried to console herself, and she said now, "It's probably just a fire mark. I put my hand to my breast when I saw the church was burning." Her father gave a start. Well, he hadn't known how long or how much she had kept to herself, and he couldn't understand that she had had the strength. His own child, and from him.
"I don't think you're truly fond of my son," Kristen said to her father many times, and Lavrans would laugh a bit and say of course he was.
He had also placed an abundance of gifts both in the cradle and in the mother's bed. But Kristen didn't think anyone cared enough for her son, least of all Erland.
"Look at him, father," she would beg. "Did you see he was laughing? Have you ever seen a more beautiful child than Nokva, father?"
She asked this same thing over and over. Once Lavran said, as if in thought,
"Hallvard, your brother, our second son, was a very handsome child."
After a moment, Kristen asked in a timid voice,
"Was he the one who lived the longest of my brothers?"
"Yes, he was 2 winters old."
"Now you mustn't cry again, my Kristen," he said gently. Neither Lavrans nor Gunnulf Nikolausen liked the fact that the boy was called Nokve. He had been baptized Nikolaus. Erland maintained that it was the same name, but Gunnulf disagreed. There were men in the sagas who had been called Nokve since heathen times. But Erland still refused to use the name that his father had borne. And Kristen always called the boy by the name Erland had spoken when he first greeted their son. In Kristen's view, there was only one person at Husaby, aside from herself, who fully realized what a splendid and promising child Nokve was. That was the new priest, Sira Eiliv. In that way, he was nearly as sensible as she was. Sira Eiliv was a short, slight man with a little round belly, which gave him a somewhat comical appearance. He was exceedingly nondescript. People who had spoken to him many times had trouble recognizing the priest, so ordinary was his face. His hair and complexion were the same color, like reddish-yellow sand, and his round, watery blue eyes were quite dull. In manner, he was subdued and diffident, but Master Gunnulf said that Sira Eiliv was so learned that he could have attained high standing if only he had not been so unassuming. But he was far less marked by his learning than by pure living, humility, and a deep love for Christ and his church. He was of low birth, and although he was not much older than Gunnulf Nikolausen, he seemed almost like an old man. Gunnulf had known him ever since they went to school together in Nidaros, and he always spoke of Eiliv Sirkson with great affection. Erland didn't think it was much of a priest they had been given at Husaby, but Kristen immediately felt great trust and affection for him. Kristen continued to live in the little house with her child, even after she had made her first visit back to church. That was a bleak day for Kristen. Sarah Iliv escorted her through the church door, but he didn't dare give her the body of Christ. She had confessed to him, but for the sin that she had committed when she became implicated in another person's ill-fated death, she would have to seek absolution from the archbishop. That morning when Gunnulf had sat with Kristen, her spirit in anguish, he had impressed upon her heart that as soon as she was out of any physical danger, she must rush to seek redemption for her soul. As soon as she had regained her health, she must keep her promise to St. Olaf. Now that he, through his intercession, had brought her son, healthy and alive, into the light and to the baptismal font, she must walk barefoot to his grave and place there her golden crown, the honored adornment of maidens, which she had guarded so poorly and unjustly worn. And Gunnulf had advised her to prepare for the journey with solitude, prayers, reading, meditation, and even fasting, although with moderation, for the sake of the nursing child. That evening, as she sat in sorrow after going to church, Gunnulf had come to her and given her a Pater Noster rosary. He told her that in countries abroad, cloister folk and priests were not the only ones who used these kinds of beads to help them with their devotions. This rosary was extremely beautiful. The beads were made of a type of yellow wood from India that smelled so sweet and wondrous, they might almost serve as a reminder of what a good prayer ought to be, a sacrifice of the heart and a yearning for help in order to live a righteous life before God. In between there were beads of amber and gold, and the cross was painted with a lovely enamel. Erland would give his young wife a look full of longing whenever he met her out in the courtyard. She had never been as beautiful as she was now, tall and slender in her simple earth-brown dress of undyed homespun, the coarse linen wimple covering her hair, neck and shoulders, merely showed even more how glowing and pure her complexion had become. When the spring sun fell on her face, it was as if the light were seeping deep into her flesh, so radiant she was. Her eyes and lips were almost transparent. When he went into the house to see the child, she would lower her great pale eyelids if he glanced at her. She seemed so modest and pure that he hardly dared touch her hand with his fingers. If she had Nokve at her breast, she would pull a corner of her wimple over the tiny glimpse of her white body. It seemed as if they were trying to send his wife away from him to heaven. Then he would joke, half angrily, with his brother and father-in-law as they sat in the hall in the evening, just men. Husaby had practically become a collegial church. Here sat Gunnulf and Sarah Iliv. His father-in-law could be considered a half-priest, and now they wanted to turn him into one too. There would be three priests on the estate. But the others laughed at him. During the spring, Erland Nikolausen supervised much of the farming on his manor. That year, all the fences were mended and the gates were put up in good time. The plowing and spring farm work were done early and properly, and Erland purchased excellent livestock. At the new year, he had been forced to slaughter a great many animals, but this was not a bad loss, as old and wretched as they were. He set the servants to burning tar and stripping off birch bark, and the farm's buildings were put in order and the roofs repaired. Such things had not been done at Husaby since old Sir Nikolaus had had his full strength. And he also sought advice and support from his wife's father. People knew that. Amidst all this work, Erland would visit friends and kinsmen in the villages along with Lavrans and his brother, the priest. But now he traveled in a suitable manner, with a couple of fit and proper servants. In the past, Erland had been in the habit of riding around with an entire entourage of undisciplined and rowdy men. The gossip, which had for so long seethed with indignation at Erland Nikolausen's shameless living and the disarray and decline at Husaby, now died down to a good-natured teasing. People smiled and said that Erland's young wife had achieved a great deal in 6 months. Shortly before St. Botolph's Day, Lavrans Björgulfsson left for Nidaros, accompanied by Master Gunnulf. Lavrans was to be the priest's guest for several days while he visited St. Olav's shrine and the other churches in town before starting his journey south to return home. He parted from his daughter and her husband with love and kindness. Chapter 6. Kristin was to go to Nidaros 3 days after the Selja men's feast day. Later in the month, the frenzy and tumult in town would have already started as St. Olav's Day neared, and before that time, the archbishop was not in residence. The evening before, Master Gunnulf came to Husaby, and very early the next morning, he went with Sira Eilev to the church for matins. The dew, gray as a pelt, covered the grass as Kristin walked to church, but the sun was gilding the forest at the top of the ridge, and the cuckoo was singing on the grassy mountainside. It looked as if she would have beautiful weather for her journey. There was no one in the church except Erland and his wife, and the priests in the illuminated choir. Erland looked at Kristen's bare feet. It must be ice cold for her to be standing on the stone floor. She would have to walk 20 miles with no escort but her prayers. He tried to lift his heart toward God, which he had not done in many years. Kristin was wearing an ash-gray robe with a rope around her waist. Underneath, he knew that she wore a shift of rough sackcloth. A homespun cloth, tightly bound, hid her hair. As they came out of the church into the morning sunshine, they were met by a maidservant carrying the child. Kristin sat down on a pile of logs. With her back to her husband, she let the boy nurse until he had had his fill before she started off. Erland stood motionless a short distance away. His cheeks were pale and cold with strain. The priests came out a little while later. They had taken off their albs in the sacristy. They stopped in front of Kristin. A few minutes later, Sira Eilev headed down toward the manor, but Gunnulf helped her tie the child securely onto her back. Around her neck hung a bag holding the golden crown, some money, and a little bread and salt. She picked up her staff, curtsied deeply before the priest, and then began walking silently north along the path leading up into the forest. Erland stayed behind, his face deathly white. Suddenly he started running. North of the church there were several small hills with scraggly grass slopes and shrubs of juniper and alpine birch that had been grazed over. Goats usually roamed there. Erland raced to the top. From there he would be able to see her for a little while longer, until she disappeared into the woods. Gunnulf slowly followed his brother. The priest looked so tall and dark in the bright morning light. He too was very pale. Erland was standing with his mouth half open, and tears streaming down his white cheeks. Abruptly he bent forward and dropped to his knees. Then he threw himself down full length on the scruffy grass. He lay there sobbing and sobbing, tugging at the heather with his long tan fingers. Gunnulf stood quite still. He stared down at the weeping man and then gazed out toward the forest where the woman had disappeared. Erland raised his head off the ground.
Gunnulf, was it necessary for you to compel her to do this? Was it necessary? He asked again. Couldn't you have offered her absolution?
The other man did not reply. Then Erland spoke again.
I made my confession and offered penance.
He sat up.
I bought for her 30 masses and an annual mass for her soul and burial in consecrated ground. I confessed my sin to Bishop Helga, and I traveled to the shrine of the Holy Blood in Schwerin. Couldn't that have helped Kristin a little?
Even though you have done that, said the priest quietly, even though you have offered God a contrite heart and been granted full reconciliation with him, you must realize that year after year you will still have to strive to erase the traces of your sin here on earth. The harm you did to the woman who is now your wife when you dragged her down, first into impure living and then into blood guilt. You cannot absolve her of that. Only God can do so, Pray that he holds his hand over her during this journey, when you can neither follow her nor protect her. And do not forget, brother, for as long as you both shall live, that you watched your wife leave your estate in this manner, for the sake of your sins more than for her own. A little later,